The cases that I have prepared for today, I've already included them in the LinkedIn invitation. So the first case, it's the oldest one from last month, that is litigation between Imholz and Emil Giesler AG. A typical ownership dispute, but let's first have a look at the representatives. The plaintiff, Imholz GmbH, is represented by Cyril Rieder from Fuhrer Marbach in Bern and assisted by Peter Walser as a patent attorney from Frey Patent Attorneys. And the defendant is represented by Maya Luschenberger, Simon Holzer as the lawyer, and Ulrike Ziesler as the patent attorney. So the register ban has already been issued for a Swiss patent application filed by Emil Giesler AG, and the register ban had already been ordered on the 15th of February, at that time ex parte, and it had been maintained in summary proceedings after the defendant has been heard with the more recent judgment of the 11th of April. As I said, it's a classic ownership dispute. The story is quickly told. Imholz GmbH, the plaintiff, is the company of a natural person called Pius Imholz, and he had been employed by the defendant, but he was not employed in R&D. He was rather employed as field staff, a salesperson in my understanding. And Mr. Imholz informed his employer about the invention that he made, and he was even involved in the drafting process of the application before filing. But apparently he had never envisaged to just hand it over for free to his employer. He rather wanted to commercialize the invention by himself with his newly founded company, Imholz GmbH, which is a plaintiff. So the key issue here is, has the invention been made under contractual obligation, so-called Diensterfindung in German, or during the course of his employed work, but not under contractual obligation, so-called Gelegenheitserfindung. The court held that the latter is much more likely based on the file as it currently stands, and accordingly a register ban has been issued ex parte first and then maintained after hearing the defendant. So main proceedings are already pending, that is case number 02023002, so watch out for that one. And the defendant had to file his statement of defense only yesterday, so it's really pretty early still in main proceedings. So that was the first case that I brought with me. The second case is one of two cases with a head note this time. That first case has case number 02021004 and 2021005. That's an infringement suit and a counter suit for nullity. That was litigation between MEFA and Novartis, and the active compound at stake is deferazirox. That's an iron chelating agent, and it's used in the treatment of iron overload, for instance, in patients that frequently receive blood transfusions. Representatives here on behalf of MEFA, that's Andrea Mondini and Andreas Welch as a patent attorney. He's working in our firm. That's the reason why I will be somewhat brief in commenting on that case. And Novartis was represented by Homburger, André Hess and Angelika Mura, and assisted by patent attorneys from the UK, from Carp Mills and Ransford. So background here, important to know, is that a PI has been issued previously against MEFA in summary proceedings. That was case number S2021005. And the PI was issued on the 15th of December 2021. So it's about 1.5 years ago. Now the judgment in main proceedings of 20 of April holds that the patents are not infringed. Quite likely the Supreme Court will still have a say on it. It's currently not clear to me whether an appeal has been filed or not, but I guess it will be filed. So for this reason, and because my firm is involved in the matter, I will be quite brief, as said. But the head notes are really outstanding in that case. So let's just walk along the head notes. The first head note is about a procedural thing. By way of background, after closure of the file, which typically is a double exchange of briefs, a patentee cannot just file a new set of claims in order to have it maintained in more limited form. And that, of course, is always tricky, in particular when the EPO opposition appeal proceedings are currently co-pending. So how do you coordinate the two proceedings? The EPO decision on the validity of the patent has ex tunc effect. And if EPO proceedings are ending with a certain scope that does not fit with the requests in national proceedings, and you cannot make it fit anymore with for procedural reasons in national litigation, then you might end up with nothing, in my opinion. But you surely would not want to try this out, surely. Note, and that's maybe important to note, from a Swiss perspective, it's not prohibited in Switzerland to lodge national nullity proceedings while EPO proceedings are pending, unlike, for instance, in Germany or the UK, to my knowledge. The present judgment provides some relief for patentees, again, if confirmed by the Supreme Court. So here's the head note, that's the first head note. The decision of a Board of Appeal of the European Patent Office, which also concerns a patent in suit, is a genuinely novel fact within the meaning of Article 229, paragraph 1, litera A, of the Code of Civil Procedure. Now, what does that mean? This means that you can introduce the respective claim set from EPO proceedings into the Swiss proceedings even after closure of the file as a proper novum. This is because, in the court's view, timing and content of the EPO decision is not fully in the hands of the patentee. If you want to read that in the judgment, that's marginal number 21 onwards. The second head note is about an issue of burden of proof. So the second head note relates to the assessment of inventive step. In particular, whether a more ambitious technical problem has been solved than just the provision of an alternative. Again, here's the head note first, burden of proof. The burden of proving the technical effects of the invention lies with the patent proprietor, period. That's quite harsh, isn't it? But which standard of proof applies? The judgment holds that the full conviction of the court applies, in German Regelbeweismaß, but further it is held that not necessarily empirical evidence of or even clinical studies are necessary. Simple scientific or theoretical reasoning may well suffice. Most importantly, I take from the decision that not only indications in favor of an alleged effect are taken into account, but rather also indications to the contrary. So when there are such indications to the contrary, less is required in order to prove the alleged effect that the plaintiff asserts. I get some notes that I'm apparently not readily understandable. That's hard for me to figure out right now how that might be explained. But anyway, I'm trying to make an audio feed, a recording, so I will upload it afterwards. I hope that at least this one will then work. So bottom line for me on that second head note is that it's, well, more or less a give and take between patentee and the defendant. Neither party can simply lean back and just assert, oh, it's not yet proven, where's the hard, very hard evidence. This will just fall on your feet. Again, if you want to read that in the judgment, that's marginal number 49 onwards. And then the third head note, it's about the doctrine of equivalence. A quick recap how infringement under the doctrine of equivalence is assessed in Switzerland. We have a three-prong questionnaire. The first question asks for the same effect of the differentiating feature, in German Gleichwirkung. The second question asks for the accessibility of this same effect, in German Auffindbarkeit. And the third question asks for equal value of that distinguishing feature, in German Gleichwertigkeit. And with respect to the second question, the judgment holds that it would be appreciated when the Supreme Court clarified its practice. And indeed, it's not fully clear to me, and obviously also not to the court, how the Supreme Court differentiates the second question from the assessment of obviousness. But be that as it may, for the time being, it was not decisive in that case here. And time will tell, hopefully soon, when the Supreme Court gets a chance to clarify its opinion on that. However, the third question is the highlight in this case. Let's first recall the third question as it currently stands in my translation. On an objective reading of the patent specification, does a skilled person come to the conclusion that the patentee, for whatever reason, has formulated the claim so narrowly that it does not claim protection for an embodiment that has the same effect, question one, and the same effect of which is even accessible, question two. So it's a safeguard in the interest of the public. I trust there will never be a clear-cut answer to this third question, to be clear. And even in simple mechanical cases, one can argue for ages. But what about numerical ranges? That was the case here. Numbers are always somewhat more precise than other technical terms, aren't they? And now we know the third head note reads as follows. Let me read that out to you. If a preferred value is mentioned in the patent and a range is claimed in the claim that includes this value, the skilled person assumes that the patent proprietor has waived protection for values outside the claimed range. Now, putting that into perspective, the claimed range here was 45 to 60%. And the preferred value in the specification was 56%. And the judgment in the reasons holds, and I now quote in my translation, under the circumstances, the skilled person has any reason to assume that the patentee has bindingly defined the range around this preferred value. The patent proprietor deliberately decided to limit the invention to this range and thus to waive the scope of protection outside of this range. Boom. Now we know. I'm certainly not objective here, but I do like it that way, to be honest. Infringement under the doctrine of equivalence in case of numerical values and ranges has always been hard to establish, and rightly so in my view. It will surely not be easier after this judgment, but let's see what the Supreme Court does with that. If you want to read the reasons of this, the Federal Patent Court on this issue, that is marginal number 79 onwards. Now, moving to the third case that I brought with me, that is actually a case that has been only published yesterday. It has been decided on my birthday, by the way, now that I see the date. That is litigation between KFI and Nestle. It's about coffee pots, and more precisely, it's about the barcode on the Vertuo pots from Nestle. Or is it a bitcode on these pots? Well, that's exactly the point. So representatives here are for KFI, Simon Holzer and Ulrike Ziesler again from MLL. And for Nestle, André Hess and Angelika Murer again from Homburger. and this time assisted by a patent attorney from the Two Birds. Again, that case comes with a head note. It's again on a procedural issue, I would say. Here it is in English, the official translation. Interpretation of the patent claim. In a civil action governed by the principle of party presentation, the court is bound by the party's shared interpretation of the patent claim. Now, what does that mean for the case at hand? All patents in suit require a barcode. And based on the evidence on file, the judge rapporteur had held that barcodes and bitcodes are not two totally separate things. More specifically, barcodes may well be binary codes, so bitcodes in essence, namely when they only code for two digits, 0 and 1. If barcodes use the width of the lines and gaps in addition, then they are no longer bitcodes, but then they are just barcodes. Fine. But that's not what the parties have unanimously pleaded as a correct understanding of what a barcode is. The parties apparently agreed that a barcode that uses lines and gaps for coding information, but wherein the information only consists of two digits, namely 0 and 1, is not a barcode according to the patent. That was undisputed between the parties. Very clearly from the decision, the court does not agree with this. But since the court shall only decide issues in dispute between the parties, it is accepted that the claim construction unanimously presented by the parties is it. In my understanding of the judgment, if the patentee had accepted that a bitcode essentially is, well, something like a subvariant of a barcode, then the patents in suit were invalid. And that's the reason why he did not. However, the clear distinction between bitcodes on the one hand and barcodes on the other hand had also implications on the infringement side. Here, plaintiff essentially argued that the code has to be taken as it is, meaning just what reaches the eye is relevant. If it looks like a barcode with lines and gaps of varying thickness, it is a barcode. On the other hand, Nestle held that a code can only be assessed with knowledge of the coded information, else it's just, well, an ornament, a picture. The court followed Nestle in this respect. Since Virtuo pods only encode a series of zeros and ones, meaning two digits, it does not infringe the claims that require a barcode, not a bitcode, as agreed between the parties. So the infringement claim was accordingly dismissed. Stakes had been very high, obviously. Nestle estimated the value in dispute as in excess of 5 million. 5 billion. In view of the remaining term of the patent of 9 years and billions of capsules being sold per year, that's maybe even on the conservative side. And now I really mixed up things. So it's billions of capsules, but it was 5 million value in dispute. Sorry. On the procedural side, what I found noteworthy is that Nestle had also filed a contingent counterclaim for a compulsory license. Now, what to do with that now that the main claim for infringement has been dismissed? Shall it not be considered, or shall it be dismissed, or shall it be deemed to never have been filed at all? That's apparently never been decided before. Now, the FPC here dealt with it in terms of costs, like an auxiliary request that had not been dealt with. So it had no influence on the value in dispute. It had no influence on the party compensation. And Nestle even gets paid back the whole court fees that had to be paid up front. Quite nice, isn't it? I wondered when I read that, why not filing a contingent counterclaim for nullity next time when one is sued for infringement and has an argument for non-infringement? So just to keep all options as a defendant. Could that make sense? It might be better than just raising a nullity plea in defense. But I would very much love to hear what the lawyers think about that. I'm just a patent attorney having some thoughts. Okay, so that was what I brought with me in terms of decisions that have been handed down. Now looking forward to the next hearings that are coming up. One hearing is actually currently running in Neuchâtel. One of my colleagues is currently visiting that hearing. That is litigation between Greubel Forsay and Purnell. That is about a wristwatch with a specific movement, a highly sophisticated movement. That is, a litigation for infringement and a nullity counterclaim in defense. I can tell more about that after the hearing. As I said, one of my colleagues is currently attending that hearing. The next hearing that is forthcoming is next Wednesday, on the 7th of June. That is litigation between Lüdi and Wobatec. That's about a, well, how do I explain that? It's a ceiling that is used in laboratories where all the ventilation things and supply for the various media, water, gases are all included in that laboratory ceiling. It's a claim for infringement, and here it's only a nullity plea in defense. And that hearing is coming up next Wednesday. Again, 1 week later, on Monday, the 12th of June, that is litigation. That's already funny from the names of the parties. That is Pear against Apple. That is a quite old case, actually. Maybe the court does not have it too urgent in cases where the patent has already lapsed and the parties are only discussing whether there is a monetary compensation due, or it's because the parties are so complicated. I get between the lines that that the briefs are pretty lengthy, at least from the plaintiff. The patentee defends the patent in suit in more than 50 requests, meaning 50 auxiliary requests, more and more limited. And the requests in the final rejoinder of the plaintiff covers about 70 pages, which might be a reason why the proceedings take quite a while. Anyway, what's at stake? It's a feature of the iMessage application that is used on Apple's iPhones. And it's all about how these icons, emojis, and then other icons are transferred over the network as an icon, as an image, or as a kind of descriptive term. Like you don't have to send a beer glass as an image over the network. If you can just code this image as the word beer, and then it's replaced at the receiving end with the appropriate image. That, in a nutshell, is what the patents are all about. Of course, Apple says this is all prior art. It's not infringed, and the patents are invalid. And we shall see and shall learn more in the main hearing on the 12th of June, litigation between Pear and Apple. And the last hearing that is currently scheduled is in litigation between Bayer Healthcare and Helve Farm. That is about sorafenib tosylate. That's a specific salt form of sorafenib. That is already a case that has been decided in summary proceedings where a PI has been issued. And now this is the main hearing in main proceedings, and yeah, it remains to be seen whether the finding of an infringement of a valid patent is confirmed in main proceedings or whether that finding is reversed. That is the hearing of the 21st of June concerning Sorafenib Tazilate. So that was what I brought with me today. I sincerely apologize if some had serious troubles, obviously, to follow my talk. I'm really angry about this LinkedIn audio feature. It's the second time that this obviously causes troubles. Maybe next time I will get back to the video event that at least worked. I'm very sorry if that did not work out for the live session. As I said up front, I prepared a recording and will share the recording afterwards. Give me a few hours until I have that prepared, and then I will share it via LinkedIn. It's a pity that we cannot discuss that if you did not have the chance to follow everything that I presented. But anyway, if you want to follow up afterwards when you had a chance to listen to the recording, I would be more than happy to discuss afterwards. Thank you very much. Have a good lunch, and maybe it was not the best time for a fireside chat. It's too warm, at least in Switzerland. But anyway, enjoy your lunch and have a great day. Thank you very much. Bye.